Welcome back tonight to the book of Ezra, a great book, a history book of a certain time in Israel's history that follows the book of Daniel and is a important time in the life of the Bible, in the story of God's people, in the story of God's reaching out to man. The book of Ezra follows, as I said, the book of Daniel and 70 years of captivity of the people of God in Babylon, 70 years that had been prophesied by Jeremiah. And Daniel knew that. He knew that that 70 years, Daniel knew when it happened. He knew the prophecies of Jeremiah. And he went into that 70th year, it looked like, counting them down and saying, okay, God, you said 70 years, and we have deserved the punishment we got. But, oh, God, you have promised that after 70 years you would bring your people back. And so God allows Daniel's life to span that time and to look ahead all the way to the time of Christ through those amazing prophecies that we looked at from chapter 7 through 12 in the book of Daniel. But now Daniel has passed from the scene, probably in his 80s, from the total of the story, and now we come to the time of return. The return of God's people, many of them, not all of them, but many of them, back to the land that their forefathers had lived in. Probably weren't very many. There could have been some very old people that were babies or young children when they were taken captive, although we don't see that, we don't hear that in the text or know that, but probably there weren't any left. There may have been people still alive who remember Jerusalem, but they were now in Babylon, and it was up to the younger people to go back when the opportunity came. Well, Ezra is going to tell the story of that going back, part of the story. Ezra is many things. Last week we talked about the different identities of who Ezra was, and one of them is Ezra is simply a historian, and he records history. He recorded the history of the kings that lived long before him and wrote a book that recorded the events following the life of David. That book is called Chronicles. And his name and his influence and his writing and his organization is associated with the books of 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Whether or not he wrote them all in their complete form or he organized and pretty much put together the material and then it was worked and reworked over the centuries, certainly Ezra is believed to be the primary recorder of history as recorded in the book of Chronicles. And several other books of the Old Testament, Ezra is believed to have been involved in their writing and their recording, at least his influence. And he was a historian in many ways. Well, what is this book about, written by Ezra? I would say as a overall theme, this book is about returning to Israel and how God brought that about and the dynamics that were going on that allowed these many people to come back to their home of their fathers and their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers. It certainly is a book about return. It's a book about a lot of things, all related to return. It is certainly a book about rebuilding the city of Jerusalem, rebuilding the place of worship that was so central to the identity of the exiles when they came home, and rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem so that they could be safe from their enemies outside. Ezra touches on both of these, and his life spans the story of the return and the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem and of the walls of Jerusalem, and how important it was that these people were able to stand on their own again. And they were coming again under the leadership, under the law of Moses, under the guidance of God. It will never be like it was back then, long ago. But it's a new era and a new time. And Ezra is there to record the things that take place and happen. It's also a time of restoring some things that had been lost, primarily restoring respect for and following the law of God, and coming back to that place of listening to the Ten Commandments, listening to what God said about justice and righteousness and all the things that they had ignored and then were punished and went into exile. It's about restoring some of those important things. And certainly the book of Ezra, and I described last week and won't take much time tonight, but just to say again that the book of Ezra is a book of revival. And the more I've thought about it, the more I've been reading and thinking and thinking of our church, I'm thinking some of the things in Ezra are so good for us. And the connected prophets to the book of Ezra that we'll come to in a few weeks, and what they say about revival and what it was like back then. Those people needed revival, and we need revival. And seeing where God spoke to them and the prophets preached to them, I think is a great story and a great thing for us to think about and to look into. And then finally, the book of Ezra is about recommitment. It's about the people saying, yes, I'm committing again to listening to the law of God. I am committing to treating my brother righteously and justly in Israel and seeking God and doing the things that God had given his people to do. Well, the book of Ezra records two major resettlements. First settlement is described in chapters 1 through 6, and the second settlement is described in chapters 7 through 10. Now, if you don't know that, you don't realize it, to me at least, when I read the book of Ezra, it's very confusing. I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute. I thought he said this, but now it seems like later, it was before then. And the book of Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther can seem that way. It's kind of hard to get the timeline down for all these events that take place during this time, but Ezra basically is divided the book into two sections. Now, it doesn't say that at the end of chapter 6, but the narrative takes you to the first settlement, chapters 1 through 6, and the second settlement, chapters 7 through 10. It's two different waves, and what's interesting is they are separated by somewhere between 30, 40, 50, or 60 years, and that's very confusing. When you read the book of Ezra, you think, well, these two settlements must be both together, but they're not. They're very different, and they take place, and I'll give a little bit of a timeline in a little bit, but they take place at two different times. And people think, well, there's no way that Ezra could have lived for 110 years during this time. And the problem is because they don't realize that the book of Ezra is not a consecutive storyline from chapter 1 to chapter 10. They're two different sections, and they're describing two different things. Well, let's read tonight in Ezra chapter 1, verse 5 through chapter 2, verse 20. That sounds like a lot. It's not as much as it sounds like, and you'll know why when we get to the genealogy, or what seems like the genealogy. But just listen to a description of the first settlement and what happened there. Chapter 1, going to start at verse 5. Then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and Levites, everyone whose heart had moved, whose heart God had moved. Boy, that's an important word not to miss there. Everyone whose heart God had moved prepared to go up and build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. All their neighbors assisted them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with valuable gifts in addition to all the freewill offerings. Moreover, King Cyrus brought out the articles belonging to the temple of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and had placed in the temple of his God. Cyrus, king of Persia, had them brought by Mithrezkadath, the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. You want to correct my vocabulary, you're welcome to. This was the inventory. Gold dishes, 30. Silver dishes, 1,000. Silver pans, gold pans, matching silver, bowls, and other articles. In all, there were 5,400 articles of gold and silver. Sheshbazzar brought all these along with the exiles when they came from Babylon to Jerusalem. Now these are the people of the province who came up from the captivity of the exiles, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had taken captive to Babylon. They returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his own town, in company with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Sarariah, Realiah, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mispar, Bigvai, Rehum, Bana, the list of the men of people of Israel, the descendants of Parash, of Shephaniah, of Aaron. Okay, that's enough. We'll stop there. Although I have to say that even studying the list, it has some interesting things in it. But the point is, all the people that God had placed in their heart to go back to Babylon, they got up and they prepared and they went. There's so many things about this story that's incredible. Number one, how could the king allow all these people to go back to Jerusalem? Why would he do that? Why would he be so favorably disposed that he would say, okay, get up and all of you people from all over Babylon, if you want to go back and your God puts it in your heart, you're welcome to do so. And the king says to all the people that live there, make sure if your neighbor goes back to Babylon, you give them a lot of gold and silver to help them so when they get back. And he says, and we're going to give back all the articles that were taken from Jerusalem for the temple, 5,400 pieces. I mean, does this story make sense? Is it logical? What about this story kind of strikes us like, is this a story? Is it true? Can it really be true? What happened here? Well, I think when we read on and we see how these books come together, it's an incredible story, a true story of the amazing hand of God in a number of ways. There were four Persian kings that are described in the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. For most of this evening, the rest of this evening, I'm going to be talking about these three books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, and how they're related and so forth like that. But there are four Persian kings. You remember back to Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and the dream is of this statue with a head of gold and a chest of silver and arms of silver and the bronze and the feet of clay and the second one is the Persian Empire. And so when we're thinking about this story and Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, we're talking about this part of the dream of Nebuchadnezzar and what happened during that time. There are four kings that are described from the first verse of the book of Ezra through the end of Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. Cyrus is the king that's quoted right here. And there's three more, and I'll just put their names up here. And I'm going to talk about them a little bit. The first one is Cyrus. And Cyrus is the king who is the last king of Daniel's reign that we know of. There's a little confusion over the name of two kings because from the book of Daniel to the book of Ezra, there seems to be a name that doesn't appear in the other one in the same context, and that's the name Darius, and I'll talk about why that is in a little bit. In the book of Daniel, you have Darius as the king who was king when Daniel went in the lion's den. But in this story, in the book of Ezra, you have Darius as the king after Cyrus, and he's very significant to the story. And in fact, all four of these kings are very significant to the story of the return of the Israelites and how that took place. Well, all these four kings are within that chest of silver. They are the Persian, the second kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. They're all Persian. And it does get a little bit confusing with the timeline. Ezra's first return that we read just a few minutes ago tonight takes place completely within the kingdom of Cyrus. The rebuilding of the temple begins to take place in that time, and it goes into the time of Darius. So You have the first return in Cyrus and the rebuilding of the temple that are described in the first six chapters of the book of Ezra, and they take place during that first time. The second return of the Israelites that's recorded in chapter 7 through 10 come all the way down at the bottom in the fourth king, Artaxerxes. So when you're reading Ezra, you start with Cyrus and you end with Artaxerxes, and it's very confusing. You think, well, what happened in between here? There's no way that Ezra lived from the time of Cyrus all the way to Artaxerxes. He would have to be 120 years old or so, something like that. Well, the reality is, the first six chapters of Ezra were not written by Ezra having experienced them, but of recording the history of what happened before he came on the scene. Ezra was never alive, or he wasn't an active priest and scribe during the days of Cyrus. He records that story before he tells his own story, starting in chapter 7. And so his story really doesn't begin until you get to Artaxerxes and his involvement in the second return. He tells about the first return, but that he wasn't a part of the first return, but he is a part of the second return. Ezra's story is storytelling and writing, oops, as we have talked about what Ezra was as a writer and historian. And so in chapters 1 through 6, he's just telling about what's happened so far. And then in chapter 7, he steps in and says, and this is what happened when I came onto the scene and the next steps that took place. And it takes place. In other words, he enters into the story in chapter 7, which is way down there at the reign of Artaxerxes. But where does Nehemiah fit into this? Nehemiah also comes into the story on the fourth king, Artaxerxes. These three kings, I mean, Nehemiah could have been there during Xerxes' reign, but it's Artaxerxes that we read about interacting with Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 1 or chapter 2 tells the story of how he has a downcast face, and his king, who's the king, Artaxerxes, says to Nehemiah, "What's the matter with you? Why are you so down? That's not like you." Again, who, and it's named in the scripture, Artaxerxes. So you have Nehemiah living during the time of Artaxerxes. You have Nehemiah, or I'm sorry, Ezra living during the time of Artaxerxes. So Ezra and Nehemiah are contemporaries, and they're telling their stories that are intertwined in the rebuilding of Jerusalem, and especially the rebuilding of the wall in Jerusalem. Ezra comes along during this fourth kingdom after the temple has already been built. But he comes along in a time when the temple's there, but the people are not worshiping God. Ezra comes onto the scene and he's watching the people who they have security now, relatively speaking, in many ways, as far as spiritually, but the walls of Jerusalem still haven't been rebuilt, and the people spiritually are still dry, and they've not come back in heart and spirit in the way that God wants them to. So when Ezra comes onto the scene, he is pleading for revival spiritually of the people. Nehemiah, his contemporary, is coming along, and God has allowed him to come back and help to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and give security to the people that are there. So that's Ezra and Nehemiah during that fourth reign. Well, where does Esther come in? Well, Esther's story, according to the book of Esther, takes place in the third reign, and the third king, Xerxes. In fact, if you just turn to Esther chapter 1, you don't have to if you don't want to, but I'll just read verse 1 of Esther. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Cush. So Esther's story begins with, I did it again, with the king Xerxes here. You remember Esther's story. Xerxes is king, and he is a very powerful king. I didn't continue to read in Esther, but Xerxes was an extremely powerful king. In fact, each of these kings were. This was a very powerful kingdom of provinces and armies, and during this time it was a very wealthy time for Persia. And Xerxes was at the height of his power, and he, according to the book of Esther, I'll just summarize it, he decided to throw a party and have all his governors come to it and all these people, and he wanted his wife to come out and dance or whatever that was about with and she wouldn't do it. And so he talks to his advisors and they tell him, you got to get rid of the queen. And so he banishes Vashti, and Esther eventually becomes queen through that story. And again, we won't take time to tell that story tonight, but Esther becomes queen to the queen of Xerxes. Many people, Bible scholars, not everyone, because it's not recorded in the scriptures, nor in Persian history is it clear. There are stories about it. Esther was given a different name, and she had a son, and he became Artaxerxes. And so many people believe that Esther's son is actually Artaxerxes. Not everybody agrees with that, biblical scholars, because there's several different records, and it's hard always to sort them out. But it would seem like after the reign of Xerxes, again, there was this return to the kindness to the Jews. You remember during Xerxes' reign and Esther, how there was this growing plot against the Jews. Why was that? Why in the kingdom, when the two kings before them had been so good to the Jews, that during the time of Xerxes, there was this dynamic story in place where there was someone who was rising up to make the king think that the Jews were causing him problems instead of helping him? That's the story of Haman and how he tried to get the king to turn on the Jews and have them put to death. You remember that? Why is that? You have Cyrus being good to the Jews because God, the prophecy about him, and Daniel and Darius, again, good to the Jews. And then you come to the time of Xerxes and there's this backlash against the Jews. And many people believe it's part of the same story that we find in Ezra chapter 2 and 3, where you have all this opposition to the building of Jerusalem again. You have people that do not want them to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And Nehemiah knows about that. And he eventually goes to the aid. And how Sanballat and Tobonite and the others are fighting against the Jews rebuilding their land. There was this backlash against the Jews rising again to power, having their own temple. Even in chapter 2 or chapter 3, which we're not going to get to tonight, you have the opposition to the building of the temple, which shut that down for about 10 years before the next king who came in said, yes, go back and read the decree of Cyrus. He said the Jews should have their temple. And then that king then allowed them to begin to build again. But there was this opposition that took place against the Jews back in Israel and in Persia. And that's being played out in the story of Esther. And so, again, there are different viewpoints from biblical scholars, but when you look at the timeline and you put it all together, whether Artaxerxes was the son of Esther, which is possible, but I don't know that to be true, it certainly fits that then Artaxerxes becomes the greatest friend of the Jews, like Cyrus was. And really, Darius was too. I mean, Cyrus just absolutely opened the door, and Artaxerxes is just making everything possible now. And Artaxerxes is the one that says to Nehemiah, yes, go, I'll give you letters. I'll deal with the people that are opposing you. Artaxerxes know that there are people that are opposing the Jews. And, you know, it goes through times and cycles of reporting and whatever, but Artaxerxes is a great rebuilder for the Jews. He is a friend of the exiles, and many people believe either because he could have been Esther's son, or at least he was born into that family, and Esther was the queen mother for a time at least. One reality is Xerxes did not live a real long time after the story of Esther because he was assassinated. So I don't remember exactly how many years. It's like 16 years or so, if I remember that right. But he was a fairly young man, and he died prematurely because he was assassinated. He was killed. And so one of his sons, Artaxerxes, who could have been the son of Esther, if I understand that right, certainly Artaxerxes. So you read in the book of Nehemiah how he helps him. And you read in the book of Ezra about Artaxerxes. And you read here in chapter 7, when you go to the second one, where do you read of Artaxerxes telling Ezra, yes, you can go back. Yes, I'll give you what you need to go back. And we'll provide, we'll give you money to go back and rebuild your city. the friend of the Jews in many ways. So when you look at these stories in historical progression, you have the first settlement in the first chapter of the book of Ezra. Then you have the temple being rebuilt and what went into that and the forces behind it and some of the dynamics. And then it would seem like Esther's story takes place. And then you come to chapter 7 in the book of Ezra, and Ezra returns, and then you have the spiritual reform and the preaching and the calling to repentance and the revival and the renewal and how important that part was. And then at about the same time, or maybe right around the same time as Ezra, they both are in Jerusalem doing their work at the same time at one point. So their lives intersect. And you have Nehemiah coming back, and then you have more of the political, military responses. Nehemiah says, if we don't build a wall around our city, we can't protect the city from all these people who are opposing us. And so Nehemiah comes back with a heart and the plan and the desire to see the city rebuilt. So Ezra chapter 1 through 6 is the opening of that story. He's the history teller. He is retelling what he has learned, what he's heard. He's writing it down like he must have done of the story of the kings 100 to 200 years earlier when he recorded that and then wrote the books of 1st and 2nd Chronicles. It's interesting that he records so meticulously the articles of the temple. I started to read that list and then kind of jumped through it, but boy, is he's thorough, he's accurate. Ezra pays attention to detail. So of all the things that Ezra is, one of them is he's very careful about the list that he accumulates. And he doesn't just kind of guess. He researches and he finds out exactly. And, you know, he could have been a very young man, could have been a boy during that first, that first return. And whoever, somebody in his family, because he was a priest, I talked about that last week, his father and grandfather, 17 generations back to Aaron, the brother of Moses. But he records meticulously these temple items. We might think, well, what's so a big deal about the temple items? I mean, you know, we have candlesticks. They're really plastic, but, you know, they're kind of made to look all right and a beautiful thing to put the Bible on and his altar. And, you know, our things are kind of how our tradition is. But I'll tell you, in the Temple of Jerusalem, those articles had great importance symbolically to the people and what was in that temple. And the fact that they were taken out and the cups were taken by Belshazzar and used for his drunken parties and how offensive that was. In fact, you remember that's what prompted the writing on the wall was the taking of the articles of the temple and offering them to Marduk. And God, whatever happened in God's heart and God's spirit, God had had enough. And when Belshazzar did that and he disrespected the temple items, I'm sure among everything else, the writing on the wall, you have been found wanting and your temple, your kingdom shall be taken from you. But Ezra records these as so important and significant. And then he gives us this long list, which I mercifully didn't try to read for your sake and mine. But boy, just look at the descendants of Parosh. I don't know who Parosh is, but he has 2,172 descendants that go back to Jerusalem. Shephatiah only had 372. Era, 775. And then, you know, some more, some less. Boy, that's some meticulous record keeping. The Jews were very meticulous in their families and clans and record keeping. Why? Because they believed that they had been chosen by God and called by God, and even in exile, their identity was important to them. It was important to them to know where they came from. It was important to them to know where their ancestral town was. It was important to know who they were related to and where they came from. And so you have this list that goes on and on. And then you get to the end, and the descendants of so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-so, and so they could not find the records for. So it's like it's evidence how important it was, because you have 100 names where they know how many descendants they have, and they have these poor six guys. The record's been lost. So when you get back to Israel, you don't have quite the same blessings as the people that know where they're from. So that's how important it is. And Ezra records that with passion. And then he tells of the temple rebuilding and the story that we find then in these chapters and beyond. In all, we have this list of all these descendants, and they total about 30,000. And then it says, trying to find the verse. Oh, it's in between my page here. The whole company numbered 42,360 besides their 7,337 men servants. Somebody had to do a really good job of counting. I don't know whether the whole entourage went at one time in the first travels. I don't know. It would seem like they kind of went together, but somebody was counting. Somebody was checking in with every tribe, every clan, every family. Okay, how many are going with you, Joe? How many are going in this caravan? Okay, and what family are you from? Okay, there's 14 of you and whatever. 42,360 Israelites. That's a lot of people. They think it took a 4 months. Would have taken 4 months to make that journey, roughly. Man, that's a lot of people. They had to be pretty organized. They had to have a lot of wealth to do that. And they did. I mean, we hear about the wealth that they have. All their neighbors gave them. I mean, this story is a lot like the book of Exodus and how the neighbors of the Israelites gave them gold and silver when they left in slavery. And here, their neighbors and the government and the king and all these people are giving them to help them to go back, not just to make it back to Israel, but so that they can rebuild the temple again. Again, that very important part of that. That's a lot of people who were going home. What do we know about these people? One thing we know about these people is they were very generous when they got back. They gave an offering. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. Another thing about the going home was the importance of the Levites and the identity of the Levites. God had said one of the tribes, your descendants will be the Levites forever for Israel, will be the priest. And it was important that if you were from the family and the tribe of Levite and you were a priest, that your son would become a priest and his son would become a priest. And all through the generations from Aaron down, the importance and the meaning, of course, Moses and Aaron were Levites. And it was important. And it wasn't just the family you were from, but the function that you did. And throughout the book of Ezra, several times it talks about the Levites did this, the Levites did that. That was their job. That was their responsibility. And so it's important. And Ezra records that. Who are the Levites? Who are the ones that were chosen to be the priest? And so you have that. You have in this story a very united purpose. They together had a goal in mind, and it was to go back and build the temple. Now, resettling was a part of it, but you hear them say, we want to go up and build the house of the Lord. Again, I'll read that verse one more time. Then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin, and my Bible and my notes are gone, and the priests of Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved, prepared to go up and build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. So it wasn't just going home and going to their settled lands, which it talks about later, but they are going with unity, and they're going with a purpose. They are going back to build the house of God. That is central to the whole story of them going home. Why was the temple so important? I mean, we have reasons why we might think this building is important. It certainly has a history, a wonderful history. But yet, I think when we step back and we really take time to think it through and pray about it and ask God to show us, we realize this isn't in itself, this building, the temple of God. The temple of God are the people of God, and the ecclesia. This is just a place that we come to, and we love it, and we have honor for it and respect for it, but we exist outside of this building. We could sit in chairs across the street, and there would be no change in our relationship with God or His calling on our lives. But in the Old Testament, it's different. The Old Testament temple represented the presence of God. The tabernacle did, and then the temple did, the very presence of God. When Jesus came, that changed. But in the Old Testament, the temple represented that God would be there in their midst and in their presence. And so when they go back, what do they do first? They build the altar. They rebuild the altar. They began with the altar. That's the first thing that we read that they do when they go back. As soon as they get back and they get in their towns and they get settled, then they begin to come together and they begin to work on the altar with great generosity. It says they took a freewill offering. Heads of the families gave 61,000 drachmas, 5,000 minas, according to their ability. I ran right past those two numbers because I must have read six different commentaries and got six different numbers of how much that was worth. So I'm really not sure, but it sounds like a lot. It goes anywhere from, in today's dollars, about $20,000 to $100,000 in today's dollars. It was a significant offering when they got back from there, when they got back from Babylon. But what did they do? It says, then Jeshua, son of Jozadak, and his fellow priest, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and his associates began to rebuild the altar of the God of Israel. They knew that their first step was to build an altar where they will sacrifice and call out and pray to God. So they do that, and they give themselves to that. They have to get in their homes. They have to find a place to live. They have to build a place for all these 42,000 people to live. But soon after that, they come together and they say, okay, the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to build the altar. Now, that included probably, but I don't know. I don't know how much the temple had been destroyed and taken out of there. And, of course, in Israel today, they're still finding pieces from the first two temples and the one that was destroyed in 66 A.D. And they say, well, this was from the first temple. There are three temples, basically, that Israel constructed in the days of Solomon and in this story. And then closer to Herod's time and in the rebuilding of the temple that took place. So three times that the temple was kind of redone like that. Well, it took 6 months for them to get the altar finished. You might think, well, man, why did it take so long? Well, 6 months sounds like a long time to us, but when they came back, again, they had to go to all their towns and get organized and get their houses built and get security, probably plant their fields and all those things. But within 6 months, they come together. And on the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, though the foundation of the Lord's temple had not been laid. So first they had to get the temple built. They had to get the altar built. And then they would work on the temple itself. And that comes in the next story. And since I don't have my notes in front of me anymore, I thought that was the last part there. So any thoughts or questions or anything about this story that you find interesting and you want to comment on? Or yeah, there was. Yeah, yep. Definitely three. There were eight Persian kings, and three of them were the name of Darius. The problem is there's a couple of them that are hazy in history. I mean, the records of history. But you're right. There was more than one Darius. And that might be that in Daniel you had Darius the First. And here you had Darius the Second, and then there was actually Darius right at the end of this. No, they did not. They did not follow at all. Plus you have, many people believe that Darius in the book of Daniel, although he's called a king once, he actually was a general. And that's what Persian history talks about, a general who ruled in Babylon for a while, but he wasn't king. He was more like Cyrus's appointed advisor, you know, so that's part of the confusion about Darius and who he is. Any other thoughts or anything about the story? Or okay, thank you. Have a great week. May the Lord watch over you and bless you. And may you sense his help and his presence. God bless. Have a good evening.